WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. This month, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame welcomes its new inductees. On today's Fresh Air, we hear from a few of them. Grandmaster Flash, who recorded with the Furious Five, and Melly Mel, who was one of the Furious Five. They'll be the first hip-hop act inducted. Also, we hear from Ronnie Spector of the girl group The Ronettes. And film critic David Edelstein reviews the new thriller Zodiac, starring Jake Gyllenhaal. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Next week in New York, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame will induct its honorees for 2007. They'll include the hip-hop group Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five and Ronnie Spector of the Ronettes. Today on Fresh Air, we'll visit with Grandmaster Flash and one of the Furious Five, Melly Mel, and with Ronnie Spector. Let's start with Melly Mel and a song called The Message. Many people consider The Message among the best rap records ever made, and it's generally acknowledged as the first that offered social commentary. Before that, most rap records were party boasts. The Message was released by Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. Melly Mel did the rap.
It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Broken glass everywhere, people pissing on the stairs, you know they just don't care. I can't take the smell, can't take the noise, got no money to move out, I guess I got no choice. Rats in the front room, roaches in the back, junkies in the alley with the baseball bat. I tried to get away, but I couldn't get far, cause a man with a tow truck repossessed my car. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Standing on the front stoop, hanging out the window, watching all the cars go by.
Melly Mel didn't write The Message. The lyric was written by Duke Booty and brought to Melly Mel by his record company, Sugar Hill. Terry Gross talked to Melly Mel about The Message in 1992.
Our group, like Flash and the Furious Five, we didn't actually want to do The Message because we was used to doing party raps, you know, and like boasting about how good we are and all that. And when the record company brought the record to us to do, we didn't actually want to do it. And I was the only one that, like, I just caved in. I said, listen, if this is the record we're going to do, then I'll just do it and it's no big thing. But I didn't think that it would be... I didn't think that it would be pivotal either way, you know, like on a good or bad note. I just thought it was going to be just another record that we had did.
So did you ever try The Message at parties before you went into the recording studio, or would that have been all wrong?
No, we never tried it. And as a matter of fact, I was shocked because we used to hang out in a club called Disco Fever up in the Bronx, right? And then they took the record, you know, they was testing it, like they tested it down on a record shop on 125th Street. You know, just putting it, you know, just letting it play and people outside, you know, listening to it. And then they tested it in the club where we hung out at, and the people really liked it. And that was coming right behind Planet Rock, which was a big, big record back then. And when they played The Message in the club and the people liked it, I was kind of shocked because I didn't think that, you know, coming from Planet Rock to, you know, a serious record like The Message, I didn't think that, I thought it would be like a lapse in you know, the level of the crowd, the intensity of the crowd. But it wasn't, so, yeah. Right then, I knew that the record was going to be more than what I thought it was going to be.
Can I ask you how you started rapping?
Well, we started going to parties. There used to be like little, like maybe $1 parties, $2 parties, and they had a DJ called Cool Herc. They was all DJs, but they rapped. They didn't actually rap in rhythm, but they used to say little phrases, you know, Coke LaRock, Timmy Tim, and Clark Kent. That was the guys' names, and they was the big DJs. They was like the big DJs back then, and we used to go to their parties, and I just started rapping, just trying to emulate them, you know, to be like them, because they was like more or less our heroes back then.
What were some of the kinds of rhymes they were using?
They wouldn't use rhymes. It's like, if you could imagine, it'd be like a dark room or a gym, and it's like smoky, because everybody was smoking everything from cigarettes to whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they be playing the music, and then it'll all be echo chamber. So they'd be like, rock, 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 free, free, free. You know,
right.
It was like more or less like kind of a psychedelic kind of thing, because everything they said, it was echoes, you know. And this is why they call me the Shoe Machine Shock, y'all. You know, it was like all this echoing. And you walk in there, you'd be like dumbfounded, because it's like you just stepped into another world, you know what I mean? And there's all these dark figures around and smoke and You know, it was like awesome. You know, for us, it was like a rush, you know, just stepping into these parties.
So what were the early rhymes you were doing?
We was doing like, you know, I'm Melly Mel and I rock so well from the top of the world to the depths of hell. This is my first rhyme of rock with the best, with the most finesse. I'm taking the top and leaving what's left, like real simple stuff, you know, just boasting rhymes, you know, nothing real heavy or nothing like that, or nothing real technical because there was no technique. We was just going by our own thing.
How did you come up with your name, Melly Mel?
Flash gave me that name. Because that was my name was just Melvin, so I don't think that would be like a cool name, like right. You know, MC Melvin. So Flash, you know, he started calling me Melly Mel and stuff. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Yo, Mel, you see that girl, man?
Yeah, man.
Yo, that sound like Cowboy, man.
What's up, fool?
Yo, what's up, money?
Yo.
Hey, where's Creole and Raheem, man?
Lay upstairs cooling out.
So what's up for the night, y'all?
Yo, we can go down to Fever, man.
Let's go check out Junebug, man.
Hey, yo, you know that girl Betty?
Yeah, man.
My mom's got balls, man.
Not what?
Again, man. She got hurt.
What did this happen? What did this happen?
What's going on? Freeze. Don't nobody move nothing. Y'all know what this is. Get him up.
What?
Get him up.
Yo, man, we down with
right
Grandmaster
man.
Flash and the Fever.
Grandmaster,
five,
what is that, a gang?
No.
Just shut up. Hey, shut up. I don't want to hear you up now.
Yo, officer, what's the problem?
Ain't no you the problem.
Our interview with Melly Mel was recorded in 1992. Now for Grandmaster Flash himself. Flash is one of the pioneer hip-hop DJs. In the 70s, he developed mixing and scratching techniques that became part of the basics of hip-hop. He started off DJing records at parties in the South Bronx. Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five was one of the first hip-hop groups to break out of the local scene and become an international success. Terry spoke with him in 2002 and started with a track from his CD that had just been released called Essential Mix Classic Edition, featuring his mix of dance hits of the 70s and 80s.
Grandmaster Flash, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
I'm interested in how you started mixing music, how you started using two turntables or maybe even more than two. Was this something you started doing at home or in clubs as a DJ?
My love for vinyl and for the turntables probably came about when I was old enough to sort of start looking into turntables and stuff of that nature. And that's probably, you know, although it was a negative experience, and when I say negative, meaning like I used to just sort of take apart electrical items in my mother's house, including turntables, just to figure out how they work and why they work. And my intention was to put it back together properly, but I just could not do it. But I just had this thing where I just had to know how the inside of a turntable worked, how the inside of a radio worked, and how my father's stereo. And that's probably where it really started, just like I had this undying interest of
Well, you basically started using turntables as if they were instruments. How did you start using turntables to change the music that you were listening to as opposed to just playing the music?
Well, I think coming up, I watched a lot of DJs in my early teens, and watching the DJs of that particular time, they were playing the music. Like my influences, although they were great positive influences. I'm talking about DJ Kool Herc and Pete DJ Jones. These two DJs inspired me to do what I did. And they would play the music, and I just sort of felt like I can take the most exciting part of a record, which we call the break, and sort of extend that, because a lot of these songs that I was listening to were like obscure funk tunes where the break section was like maybe 10 seconds long. And from a frustrated point of view, I had this thought that if I can just come up with a system, a way of just taking duplicate copies of the record with two turntables and a mixer, I can extend that five or 10 second part seamlessly and make it 10 minutes if I wanted to. And that's you know, my thoughts manifested into creating an art form called the quick mix theory, which is actually taking a passage of music or two duplicate copies of vinyl and sort of moving the disc back and forth and repeating a section of the passage, you know, between duplicate copies of the record. That's where it started.
Because you were putting the needle down on exactly the right part of the record with the rhythm that you wanted to hear, could you actually, you know, some people say that you were able to look at the grooves of a vinyl record and know exactly where the rhythm was that you wanted, that you could actually see it in the grooves.
Well, actually, you know, I was pretty decent at it, but it was my first student that I taught this quick mix theory to, Grand Wizard Theodore, was probably the best at that, and it was called needle drops. But what I came up with is what I call the clock theory, and the clock theory was where you would place the needles down on both copies of the vinyl, and when the ending of one was over, you would push in the next fader, but while the other one was playing, you would sort of spin the record back one or two revolutions to the top of that break, and then when the other one was over, you would push in the other. So it was like push, spin back, push, spin back. So I actually never, you know, this made it an assured way of being able to get back to the beginning of the break section without actually having to pull the needle up. And what I would do is I would mark, like on the label, if it was like a record from if it was a 12-inch from Atlantic Records, and if the break began at, let's just say, at the top of the A, I would sort of put like a magic marker right there. So that would be my clock of where I had to bring the record back to, one or two revolutions back, to re-arrive at the top of the break. And I would just sort of do this with two copies of records back and forth. So picking up the needle, you know, was no longer an issue, because that day wasn't definite, because once you picked it up, you know, I could always get close to it, but it was never really, like, exact. And creating the clock theory, which all DJs use today now, where they mark the album at a certain point, is one of my contributions to the art of the DJ mix.
Grandmaster Flash, speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2002 interview with Grandmaster Flash, one of hip-hop's turntable pioneers. Grandmaster Flash and his influential group, the Furious Five, will be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame next week in New York.
It was scratching something that you invented, or was that invented by one of the people who influenced you?
Well, actually, it was called cutting, and the whole thing was, like I said earlier in the interview, called the quick mix theory, and we called it cutting because it was actually taking a section of the rhythm and rearranging it. And this is something that I've created over 27 years ago.
You must have really been intense.
Well, I probably was more frustrated than anything, because, I mean, so much stuff I had to buy, like a lot of it was trial and error, you know, trying to get my hands on the right needle. You know, I had to go through countless needles, you know, trying to find the right turntable. I had to go through countless turntables and then finding the right mixer, but then it didn't have a system where I can pre-hear the music in my head, so I had to create something called the Peekaboo system. So I had to, like, actually jury-rig these things, you know. That's why I had to go into backyards and look for stuff and go through abandoned cars or ask people, you know, that might have been throwing away stuff. Just, you know, just so that I can just basically have these things. But at this point in time, I still didn't know what these internal parts was. So while I was tearing up all the stuff inside my mother's house and became like public enemy number one with my sisters and stuff, my mother decided to send me to school.
What kind of school?
Samuel Gompers Vocational and Technical High School. And that's where I started to understand, like, what is a resistor? What is a capacitor? What is AC versus DC? What is a transformer? What's a push-pull circuit? What's a diode rectifier? What's are transistorized versus tubes, and what's an ohmmeter, and what's an oscilloscope, and what's a wave, and you know, I started like actually understanding as I was, you know, not so now when I tore into something, I sort of had somewhat of an idea of what it is and what it did. So all these things helped me to jury rig and to put together the system so that I can start on getting this concept out of my head that just kept, you know, it just kept staying in my head, so to speak.
Why don't we listen to one of your now classic recordings, and this is The Adventures of Grandmaster Flash on the Wheels of Steel.
You see, one for the trouble, two for the time. Come on, girls, let's rock that.
Bad Bad Betty told me everybody's side. DJ is spinning, I said, my, Flash is back. Flash is cool, front slots and
bar,
flush ain't no
do. You say one for the trouble, two for the time. Come on, girls, let's rock that.
That's Grandmaster Flash from the early 80s, one of his classic recordings, The Adventures of Grandmaster Flash on the Wheels of Steel. You know what I'd like to do? I'd like to hear that again, but this time, keep your microphone on and have you describe what you're doing as we listen to it. Here we go.
You see,
Punch Face.
You see,
Spoon and G Monster Jam. I let it go there.
Time. Come on, girls, let's rock that.
It's a Blondie here.
DJ spinning, I said, my,
Punch Face. Punch Face.
Flash is cool,
front slots
and bar, flush ain't no
dude.
Back to Spoonie again.
Time. Come on, girls, let's rock that.
Into Good Times, Chic. Into Apache on the Rub. Cutting it up. Back in again. Punch Face, Queen, another one Bites the Dust, in. Cutting into rhythm, I'm using Good Times to rub the rhythm against Queen. Good Times by Chic.
That release is so nice, the way it synchronizes there.
Thank you. That's the whole key to it, you know. That's what my contribution is, keeping it on time. That was like the key.
Grandmaster, come faster.
It's I Punch Face from Freedom.
Grandmaster, come faster.
Cutting it up.
Grandmaster, come faster.
Punch Face in Good Times. Back to Good Times.
When we left off in your development as a DJ, you were still working at home and scavenging audio equipment from junked cars and things like that. Once you perfected your technique and you started working parties and then working in clubs, what was it like for you to see the reaction of the crowds to the thing that you had been doing alone in your home?
You know, I watch these songs, certain DJs play it from the beginning, and I knew that at that particular part is where the audience went wild. So I figured, let me just go to the part of these songs and just do them one behind another, but it was just extremely quiet. And it turned out that the real fact of the matter is vocal entertainment was sort of needed to accompany this new way of DJing. And I made the first attempt, and I was totally horrible of trying to like rap with my mixing, and it was really too much to do at one time because it's constantly, you know, it's a constant, you know, taking records on, taking them off, putting them on, you know. So I was horrible at it, and then what I would do is basically put a microphone out on the other side of the table, and anyone that thought that they can verbalize to this newfound science of mixing, please feel free, you know. Everybody failed except for this one person who probably was like the savior of my esteem. His name was Keith Wiggins. He was my first MC. He went by the name of Cowboy. And Cowboy had a way of, he reminded me of like a ringmaster at the circus, you know, and he had a very commanding voice. And he came up with a verbalization, like, you know, throw your hands in the air, say this, ho, say party, and this and that. So that was the perfect diversionary tactic to get people off of looking at me and to look at him and do what he says do while I go through a series of breaks, you know, just playing one behind another seamlessly to the beat.
Grandmaster Flash speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. Grandmaster Flash and his influential group, the Furious Five, will be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame next week in New York. It's the first time a hip-hop act has been honored there. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Freeze! Rock, 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 rock.
Bass.
Dreams of passion
flowing through my mind,
and all the while I think of you.
Hi,
a very strange reaction.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Virginia Woolf's early novel Night and Day, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, sponsoring Philadelphia's new audio walking tours called Sound About Philly at soundaboutphilly.com. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, beautiful harmonies and high hair. We talk with Ronnie Spector of the girl group The Ronettes. Their first big hit was Be My Baby. The group will be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame next weekend. Also, David Edelstein reviews the new thriller Zodiac, starring Jake Gyllenhaal. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. To continue our salute to some of this year's inductees to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, we visit with Ronnie Spector, lead singer of the Ronettes. Alan Betrock, author of The Girl Groups, described the Ronettes as the pinnacle of the girl group era and called their first big hit, Be My Baby, the perfect pop record. Ronnie Spector is long divorced from Phil Spector, the famous record producer whose trademark wall of sound helped the Ronettes and several other performers vault to fame in the 1960s. As a solo artist, Ronnie Spector continues to make records. Her latest CD, Last of the Rock Stars, was released last year. Next week in New York, she and the other Ronettes will be inducted into the Hall of Fame. Doing the honors of introducing them, Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones. Terry spoke to Ronnie Spector 20 years ago. Here's her great hit, Be My Baby.
First hear this song, did the songwriter sing it for you before you performed it the first time?
Well, the first time I heard it, you know, Phil and those were and Ellie Greenwich and Jeff Barry, we met in a little studio, and they started writing around me, and I guess I was 16 years old and very shy, and I liked Phil at the time and he liked me. I think they wrote it all around that, you know, our little love affair at the beginning. I think it was all a part of that. The lyrics and stuff.
Do you remember the recording session?
Like it was yesterday.
What was it like?
It was incredible, because there I was in California recording, and I'd never left New York. I'd never been out of New York in my whole life. And there I am on a plane going to California by myself without the other two Ronettes, just to do the lead part. And I remember being in the ladies' room at the New York airport, just singing in the bathroom, Be My, because I don't read music or anything, and I don't play any instruments. So it was like you had to just learn it over and over. And that's how, and then Phil asked me to come to California and do it at Gold Star Studios. And that's where we recorded it, and I loved it. I love it till today. I still love it. I mean, it's just a record that I remember that day being in the studio. I remember what color dress I was wearing. I remember everything.
You formed the Ronettes with two of your cousins when you were all teenagers.
No, a sister and a cousin.
A sister and a cousin. Okay. Now, how did you learn to sing harmonies?
Actually, it was like a bunch of cousins. I had so many first cousins. It was like three other girls besides the two Ronettes, and it was a boy cousin singing lead, and it just sort of narrowed down to one. And I remember the three of us being on the rooftop, like learning routines, because we never had a choreographer or anything. We sort of did what the street dances and stuff, and we just made it three. And I remember being on the rooftop, you know, rehearsing and trying to get our routines together and stuff for the Brooklyn Fox. And what did you say? How did we get together? It was a family, and we had a sort of strict upbringing. So we couldn't go out, and we could look out in the street and watch other girls walk and everything, but we couldn't go out because our grandmother was very strict. So we stayed in the house, and that's how we all just started singing, because out of boredom and out of all the people in our neighborhood were, like, becoming stars, like Frankie Lyman and stuff. And when I met him, I was in love with him. I didn't even know him, and I was in love with him. I was in love with his voice.
What kind of neighborhood was it that you grew up in?
I grew up in Spanish Harlem, which was terrific, because it was like every race, every color, every language. It was wonderful.
You know, speaking of every race, a friend of mine has always wondered what your ethnic background was, because he thought that you looked... Sometimes you looked white, sometimes you looked black, sometimes Hispanic, sometimes Italian, you know?
I know.
And he thought it made you especially mysterious and intriguing.
Well, what I really am, and this is the truth, my father's Irish, and my mother is black and Indian. And every time somebody says black and Indian, they say, oh, come on, they don't have Indian. My mother is really half Indian, and she has a high cheekbones. And so I do look like all of those races. I mean, my sister's married to Chinese. My cousin in the Ronettes is half Spanish. So our whole family was sort of mixed up, you know, racially.
Well, I guess that explains it.
Yeah. So it's like there's Chinese, Spanish, there's Irish, there's no Italian, no Jews. But you may as well say there's everybody. That's why I love growing up in Spanish Harlem, because There was a little Chinese guy used to play with Ben. Their family owned the laundry in the neighborhood. And we just didn't think about color and stuff till I got much, much older. I didn't even know about it.
You broke in through into the music business by being a dancer at the Peppermint Lounge, being a dancer on the Murray the K Show,
right.
Singing backup vocals. Did you do things in those early days to help get yourself noticed? Did you either like dress in such a way as to call attention to yourself? Okay, what'd you do?
First of all, we tried to. You have to have a gimmick in this business, we figured, and so we wore our hair extra high. You know, the beehives in the '60s, and we wore eyeliner. You know, like Chinese eyes almost, and we wore slits up the side of our dresses because we sang and danced. So we really looked different. And what was the question? I forget. I get so excited.
Oh, about things you did to call attention to yourself when you're trying to break in.
See, when we first we decided to dress up, and we had a lot of aunts. My mother has like six sisters, and so that's seven of them dressing us. And they told us to put a cigarette in our mouth, and we stood outside the Peppermint Lounge dressed just alike. And I was so glad because at 14 I was smoking. They just didn't know it, and it was great because we stood online and we had to look older. So we had to exaggerate everything because all of us were underage. So it was very hard, but we had our gimmick, and it was amazing because before we even had Be My Baby as a hit record, being at the Brooklyn Foxes, Murray the K's Dancing Girls, we would come out for lunch, and it was actual girls dressed like us and our hairstyles. It was knocking me out. I couldn't believe it.
You had some of the highest hair in the whole music business.
Well, that's what I said. You had to have a little attention. And we certainly brought attention with those high hairdos. I mean, we must have worn our hair at least 10 inches high. And we had all of our hair was real, you know. And that was, most girls didn't have either that longer hair, or if they did, they didn't keep it that long. So we kept our hair long and all that stuff, too, to have that gimmick.
Now, you know, it always made me think that you were really tough, really streetwise.
No.
Where, you know?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, when we heard about people being junkies or dope addicts, I would ask my mother, well, let me see one, because the way my family would talk about them, it was like it was a disease, because I was very young and I didn't know. And I was like afraid of them before I even met them because I didn't know what they looked like. So I wasn't a tough streetwise kid at all. But we just did all the dances. You know, and by living in Spanish Harlem, you learned all the dances anyway. I mean, you could just look out the window and people were on the corner singing and stuff. And it just how we, and I loved it. From the time I was 3 years old, when my whole family applauded me, I remember the song was Jambalina Kofi Spina Fili Gambo. Cause tonight I'm gonna meet Mom Shadow Mio. Pick a spot filled with Guy Handy Gale. Son of a gun, we're having fun on the bayou. And I think that's when I got my ho, 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 ho. And then my family just started applauding me, and I was like 3 years old. And I said, that's what I want to be the rest of my life. I want to perform.
Ronnie Spector speaking to Terry Gross in 1987. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1987 interview with Ronnie Spector. She and her 1960s girl group, the Ronettes, are being inducted next weekend into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Let's get to more of your recordings with the Ronettes. You first signed with a small label called Colpix Records.
And, that's right.
Those records never really became hits. How did you sign with Phil Spector, with whom you really recorded your best-known records?
Well, what we did, we were still with Colpix at the time when we met Phil. And he had my mother go down to Colpix Records and tell them that we didn't want any part of show business. We wanted to go back to school, and we just didn't want to sing anymore. And this was all Phil's plan, and my mother's and Phil's plan to get us on his label. So they released us, Colpix, and naturally we hadn't had any hits from them, so it wasn't like they were letting go these big stars. You know, we hadn't had any hit records, so it was perfect. And my mother went there one day, and she got them to release us because we were underage, and my mother said, they don't want to sing anymore. And about 6 months later, we had a number one record, so.
fooled everybody.
Yeah. So that's how how we got to be with Phil on Philly's Records. But that's not how we met him, you see. My sister and myself and my cousin got together one night, and we said, how are we going to meet this Phil Spector? We hear he's the best producer in the world. And my sister said, well, why don't we pretend we're dialing him. We knew the number to his office. And we would pretend it's the wrong number and just say we're backup singers and we'd love to come down and audition for him. And that's what we did. We called his office one day and we said, hi. We're calling for an audition. We're the Ronettes. And they said, well, you must have, her name was Joni, Phil's secretary. And well, maybe, I don't know if Phil is auditioning, that I hold on. So we held on, and next thing we know, Phil was on the phone, and he said, I'd like to meet you girls the next night at Mirror Sound here in New York. And we couldn't believe it, and we did. And, yeah, we sat down at the piano at Mirror Sound, and Phil said, sing me some songs that you guys just, know off the radio. And, of course, by my loving Frankie Lyman, I started singing Why Do Fools Fall in Love, ABCs of Love, and he immediately fell in love with my voice. And he said, that's the voice I've been looking for.
Once he started working with you, did he make suggestions to you and the Ronettes about changes he wanted to hear in either the harmonies or the lead vocals?
No, because first of all, the backgrounds weren't just my sister and my cousin. It was like we had about 10 people. There was Cher, there was Sonny, there was Darlene Love. I mean, we had so many background singers on our records at the time. The lead singer was the most important. And the wall of sound. In the background, he had like 10, 20, and he would make those, double those voices. So it was, I don't know, it was very complicated in the studio, but it was, watching him work was a miracle to me, watching Phil Spector work in the studio.
You both became lovers. Did that add a certain drama to your performances when you worked together?
It may have, but I guess because I was, performing so much before I met him, I just had that, I love performing, and I don't think he, by falling in love with him, made me any better as far as my singing. I just think he knew what materials to pick out for us, song-wise, like Be My Baby, Walking in the Rain, and he was just a great producer.
Walking in the Rain, we've heard some of Be My Babies. Walking in the Rain, one of your favorites of the records that you recorded?
Be My Baby is my number one. I love it forever. And Walking in the Rain, I love it too. Yes, I really do.
I love that too. Why don't we hear a few seconds of it, and then we'll talk some
more.
Okay, this is the Ronettes.
I want him, and I need him, and someday, someway, whoa, 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 I'll meet him. He'll be kind of shy, and real good looking too, and I'll be certain he's my guy by the things he'll like to do. Like walking in the rain and wishing on the stars up above and being so in love. Oh, oh, oh.
Oh, Ronnie, that sounds great. That's Ronnie Spector singing along with a record from the 1960s of Walking in the Rain.
I couldn't help it,
Terry. Oh, that's terrific. I'm thinking that the Motown girl groups had charm school and professional choreographers,
yes.
Chaperones, all of that. Did you ever want evening gowns? Did you ever want the kind of polish that the groups like the Supremes had?
No, we didn't. We were strictly rock and roll. And I remember one of my sister's boyfriends at the time, he came over to our house while we were doing our rehearsals, at my mom's house, you know. And he said, why don't you guys try to be more classy and act like the Supremes and, you know, stand there and with your aunt. I said, look, we're rock and roll. We got to move. We were singing songs like What I Say, La Bamba, you know, Turn On Your Love Lights. And we were really rock and roll. And rock and roll to me is not just standing there and having a choreographer. It's being real. It's rocking and rolling and not having being so choreographed. I can't have it now.
You gave up rock and roll for a while when you married Phil Spector.
That's not the right way to put it. I didn't give it up. As a matter of fact, I didn't know when I got married that I would never sing again. I thought, as a matter of fact, I would be recording a little bit more and maybe touring a little less. But I had no idea I would never record again or sing again or perform again. I sang again, but I didn't perform again.
So it was kind of against your will that you
started. Yeah, it was something I didn't expect.
Well, during that period, did you sing a lot in the house just to keep your voice in shape?
No, because there was no rock and roll allowed in my house then. It was only classical music played throughout the whole house, and how can I sing the classical music, you know, rock and roll? And I just didn't sing. I just, at night I would go to sleep, I remember, and just turn over and just think about being on stage and singing. Occasionally when I was in the bathroom or in the bathtub, I'd sing songs and stuff, but never too loud because he'd get angry.
Yeah, there was no rock and roll because your husband of the time, Phil Spector, didn't want it in the house. When you left that marriage and you left mm-hmm. him and you tried to re-enter the music business again, had you lost your bearings for a while? Was it hard for you to find your place? You'd been out of the scene for a while, mm-hmm. and you hadn't even been listening to the music for a while.
Right. No, but I never lost my bearing. It's like, I guess it's like riding a bicycle. Once you, you know, learn, once you fall off, you get right back on. And that's how I was with my singing. Of course, it was much tougher. I remember I came back in 74, and I went to Buddha Records, and they auditioned me. They loved me. And a few weeks later, Phil sent them a letter saying that I was still his wife because it took me 2 years to get a divorce. And immediately they let me go, so I had a lot against me because of Phil. You know, people just said, well, we don't want to be bothered with him because he was known for suing people and, you know, making scenes and keeping people in court. And that's basically why I didn't get started as fast as I wanted to, you know, because everywhere I went, he sort of like, you know, stuck his two cents in at the time.
Well, I'm glad you're back recording and performing again. It's a pleasure to hear your voice
again.
Thank
you, Terry. I'm so glad to be back.
And I thank you very much for spending some time with us on Fresh Air.
Oh, anytime.
Ronnie Spector speaking to Terry Gross in 1987. Next week, she and the Ronettes will be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And the week after that, jury selection begins in the Los Angeles murder trial of her ex-husband, Phil Spector, who's accused of killing actress Lana Clarkson. Oh, and yes, if you're wondering, that trial will be televised. And now, let's hear a song from another of this year's Hall of Fame inductees, Patti Smith, off her upcoming album of cover versions. This is Are You Experienced?
If you can just get your mind together, then come on across to me. We'll hold hands and then we'll watch the sunrise from the bottom of the sea. Are you experienced? Have you ever been experienced? Well, you're made out of gold and can't be sold. So, are you experienced? Have you ever? Been experienced? Well,
Coming up, David Edelstein reviews The Zodiac. This is Fresh Air. The unsolved Zodiac murder case of the 60s and 70s became the inspiration for the modern serial killer genre. But the original still obsesses people. Among them, director David Fincher, who made his own Zodiac-like thriller, Seven. Fincher's new film, Zodiac, stars Jake Gyllenhaal, Robert Downey Jr., and Mark Ruffalo. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Zodiac centers on the hunt for a California sociopath who murdered people at random in the 60s and 70s, all the while taunting San Francisco Bay Area police and newspaper editors with threats and bizarre cryptograms. There was and is a lot of evidence pointing to one suspect, but the man was never tried and is long dead. Consequently, this is a very unusual serial killer movie. It begins with an attack on a couple, then turns into a fairly standard police procedural, with one more murder set piece and a lot of discussion among cops and newspapermen. And then, well, where do you go without the big Dirty Harry climax and resolution? Or any resolution? The director, David Fincher, aims to make the lack of closure a source of creeps. And in the movie's roundabout way, it does get at something transcendentally icky about the fetish for serial killers that's only grown more popular. Zodiac is a movie about the allure of grotesque puzzles and about living with the boogeyman, even after the boogeyman, in all likelihood, no longer lives. The nominal protagonist isn't a cop or even an investigative reporter, but a young San Francisco Chronicle editorial cartoonist, Robert Graysmith, played by Jake Gyllenhaal. It seems like an odd choice, but then Graysmith eventually gave up editorial cartooning and wrote the two rambling, evidence-packed best-selling books the movie is based on, Zodiac and Zodiac Unmasked. After the first coded letter comes into the newspaper, he begins to haunt the desk of the reporter writing the stories, Paul Avery, played by Robert Downey Jr. Graysmith is the gee-whiz former Eagle Scout, Avery, the cynical alcoholic. But the pair have a lively rapport over drinks and code books and a copy of the Zodiac's letter.
In the first cipher?
You actually carry that around with you?
Why?
No reason.
What's the most common double consonant in the English language?
Consonant?
The double L.
Double L.
And what's the one word that we know that he'll use in here at least once?
Kill.
Right, Teal. So the Hardens start looking for double symbols, which they find here, here, and here, each with the same two symbols preceding them. So now they've got a repeating four-letter word ending with two symbols that they assume stand for L.
And since I think the whole word is kill.
And you got your K, you got your I, and you're on your way.
But how do you go from A as one and B as two to figuring out this whole cut?
Well, same way I did. You go to the library. In this book, the author presents a very simple substitution code in the preface. 8 of the 26 symbols that he suggests are found in this cipher.
But there are non-letter symbols, because there's all these medieval ones.
I thought they looked medieval, too. But then I found a code written in the Middle Ages. Guess what it's called? The Zodiac alphabet.
Watching these sleuths put this puzzle together is fun. And there are other lively scenes between Gyllenhaal and Mark Ruffalo as San Francisco Police Inspector Dave Tashi. Zodiac is low-key but intense, like Alan Pakula's journalistic puzzle movie All the President's Men, and the excellent actors talk quickly and play it close to the vest. But it's the more conventional serial killer stuff that freezes the blood. like the opening attack on a couple in a parked car at night, with distant July 4th fireworks and the sound of Donovan's song Hurdy Gurdy Man. The face of the figure that approaches the car from behind out of a sudden bright light is always on the brink of visibility, and the shots when they come blast right through your head. The second murder set piece is in some ways the greater and more perverse achievement. In daylight, in the open, the hooded Zodiac addressing his tied up and prone targets in almost reassuring tones. Still, the movie itself feels like an unfinished puzzle, choppy and diffuse. Maybe vital connecting material was lopped out in the editing room, although the thing still runs 2.5 hours. Or maybe the screenwriter, James Vanderbilt, couldn't hack a clear narrative path through Graysmith's books. Something is missing. Empathy. Emotional glue. You're supposed to register how obsessed Graysmith is becoming, to the point where his wife, played by Chloe Sevigny, decamps with the kids. But Fincher, as he proved in the movie Seven, is a cold and rather clinical director. He doesn't seem to share his protagonist's moral outrage, or even his fascination with minutia. He's a mood ghoul. Even if Fincher were a more empathetic director, though, Zodiac might not have had the emotional kick it would have had 10 or 20 years ago. Spending one's life in a quest for justice by poring over forensic files and exhuming cold cases might once have been considered abnormal behavior. But today, with thousands of true crime blogs and celebrity forensic scientists, it's grand escapist entertainment for the masses.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. You can download Fresh Air as a podcast at our website, freshair.npr.org. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. And from Anne and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching, at breakthroughcollaborative.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, The Jesus Machine. We talk with journalist Dan Gilgoff about Focus on the Family and its founder, James Dobson, and how it became the most powerful organization in the Christian right. Gilgoff got a rare inside look at the organization for his new book. Join us for the next Fresh Air.